This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Today on the show, colonialism is alive and well. On the show, Melina Labakan Massimo. Music by Testament and Resident Antihero. Check out the interviews and more on the webpage. This is Rage, building a community of resistance, one podcast at a time. Hello and welcome to Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide, coming to you from occupied Amiskwiskiwiskigan. I am your host, Seymour Life. And a special hello goes to all those who believe there's a living world more important than the market. This week we start our series on colonialism, and because nothing should be linear, I'm going to interweave that with other shows. So this will, the parts of colonialism versus the parts of non-human interviews, etc., will be all intertwined with each other. Because none of these issues really actually stand solely on their own. They are very much intertwined within each other. Colonialism today is really pretty much corporatism, and it's too bad that the ENGOs, environmental non-governmental organizations, that signed the CBFA, the Canadian Betrayed Forest Action, don't and did not understand that at the time they signed it. Pretty much just sold out again to the corporations, which I've been saying a lot, and there'll be more on this coming up as well over the month. The whole thing around colonialism is this corporatism is becoming more and more blatant and more evident everywhere we look now. Even Europe's being recolonized with GM foods, designer crops, unfair financial practices. And, well, unfair financial practices was the whole reason for the American Revolution. At least so they say. So the show is to talk about colonialism from a lot of different perspectives. And today we'll have Melina Labakan Massimo on. We'll talk about, from her perspective, what colonialism is and her people's experience with colonialism. So without further ado, my discussion with Melina. And I'll start off by asking her how she would describe herself.
So my name is Melina Miawapin Labakan Massimo. I'm Cree from the Labakan Cree First Nation, as well as mixed blood. My mom's Italian-American from the South. So I have kind of walked two roads, I guess. Have my foot in both worlds and trying to, the way I see it, is bridging gaps between Indigenous communities and trying to bridge and create solidarity between communities that haven't always worked in solidarity with First Nations communities, which I think is very important if we're going to be making any progress in the kind of issues that we see happening and arising today. I was born in Peace River, in the Peace River region, which is one of the tar sands regions in Alberta. We moved to the city, and I actually went to high school and university here in the city, and I did my Bachelor of Arts here. After I finished my BA, I traveled and worked in Brazil, also went to school a bit in Mexico, took some training programs in Australia. And then I've been mostly working on Indigenous sovereignty, Indigenous rights for the past 10 years. Through a variety of different ways, whether it be through media arts. I worked with the Indigenous Media Arts Group and the Red Wire Media Society, producing Indigenous media, essentially, as well as I currently work on tar sands issues and how the tar sands are affecting Indigenous peoples, traditional territories. And I was doing my master's in environmental studies before I came back to work on issues locally, and also have had family members that have dealt with health issues, probably because they lived in the areas where there's a lot of development. Basically have traveled, but live here, live home, and work on tar sands and climate and energy issues.
Prime Minister Harper said that Canada does not have a history of colonialism. So from your point of view, how would you describe colonialism? What is colonialism? And then I have the two sort of second part. The other part is, how is it still being continued in Canada?
I would say the whole premise of Canada is based on colonization. So I wouldn't agree with Prime Minister Harper's statement that colonization doesn't exist in Canada, because I don't think Canada would exist otherwise. So right there, I would say colonization is basically coming over into, you know, what happened in Canada, specifically coming over into traditional territories of Indigenous peoples, and either pushing Indigenous peoples out of those territories, forcing them into quote-unquote reservations, enforcing policies that were very oppressive and systematically oppressive towards Indigenous peoples, like the Indian Act, where Indigenous peoples were denied a variety of different rights and denied basic rights, you know, the ability to meet in groups more than three, the ability to have legal representation, the inability to vote, or even the inability to govern ourselves in the traditional forms of governance. When there's an imposition of, you know, colonial policies, I think that's colonization right then and there. And then also the fact that, you know, not even being able to practice our traditional spirituality, practice our traditional ceremonies, those were banned outright through the various forms of the Indian Act. So I think there's a lot of different ways that we could look at, you know, how Canada, through its process of colonization and assimilation, was created to systematically oppress Indigenous peoples. And what we see now is essentially the outcomes of that, these policies that were implemented. And now we see essentially Indigenous peoples playing out those legacies that have been really detrimental to our communities. The breakdown of the social fabric of our communities has essentially happened through residential schools, through the 60s scoop, all of these different ways in which Indigenous peoples were denied the right to exist as Indigenous peoples or First Nation peoples.
And how is that still continuing today? Like, how is that sort of still represented?
The way I definitely see colonization today is like another wave of colonization, is what I've been saying. And what I've been calling it is a second wave of colonization, or another wave through resource exploitation, resource extraction, where first the social fabric or the social makeup of Indigenous communities were deconstructed. And then from there, now we have all these issues of like alcoholism in our communities because of residential schools, like because of coping mechanisms that have, you know, needed, that have taken place, like all of these detrimental effects. But now we have another wave here that is through resource extraction, where people have been colonized, but now the land is being further colonized.
So then specifically in your case, how has it affected your people?
Well, I come from a community that is the Lubicon Cree. Some people know about it, especially during the 80s when the community did erect blockades to say, no, we do not want logging in our traditional territory. We have not given consent to this. And so blockades were erected. But from that, you know, from the government essentially, which is unceded territory, Lubicon territory is unceded territory. It was never signed over in treaty. Essentially what the government has done since then has given permits to logging companies, to oil and gas companies, to extract resources from the traditional territory. So in the past, you know, less than 30 years, over $14 billion has been taken out of the traditional territory through resource extraction in revenue. And yet, like, you know, the community still goes without running water. The community still, you know, doesn't have like services that it needs. You know, the fact that all of these resources are coming from our traditional territory, yet we don't even profit or benefit, to say the least. We experience the detrimental effects where the water is being contaminated, the air is being contaminated, the water sources are being drained, like Lucan Lake. Like it was more of, it was still a shallow lake, but now it looks like a muskeg. Like it doesn't even look like it looks like a lake anymore, more like a pond.
Right.
So just things like that, where you see really detrimental effects happening into Indigenous communities, because they're usually on the front line of those developments. Essentially, Indigenous people have always been, we see ourselves as stewards of the land, where you're looking after the land, and you see the reciprocal relationship or the reciprocity that happens between humans and our ecosystems that surround us, that give us life. So as caretakers of those, that's why they were in these conditions, these pristine conditions. They just weren't there just because. And now, because they're the last, as industrialization or exploitation is going further and further up north into more Indigenous traditional territory, that's what we see is happening, that there's more destruction happening, and Indigenous communities are the front line and seeing these destructive patterns happen.
And then what specific institutes would you say are involved in that?
Variety of different government bodies, whether it be from Alberta Environment, whether it be from the Department of Indian Affairs, you know, whether it be from the Ministry of Economy, that's what we like to call it, but Minister of Environment. There's a lot of systematic policies that are put in place to kind of not allow Indigenous peoples to fully carry out their traditional rights and also their treaty rights and Aboriginal inherent rights, which actually are protected in Section 35 of the Canadian Constitution. And those rights aren't even being, you know, they're stated in the Constitution, but they're not being protected and they're not being enforced when they should be, because they're part of the Canadian Constitution, where people say we need to abide by these laws here in Canada, but yet they don't even respect their own laws and follow their own laws when if it's not convenient for them.
Just a quick thought. I know one of the things that has often been talked about are water management right now in Alberta, and they're talking about first in, or what's the term now?
First time, first in line. Or
yeah, exactly. And then, but on top, again, Indigenous people aren't even at the table when talking about that. And to me, it's like, well, they're first in time, right?
Yeah, it's true. It's very true. And the fact that, you know, when Indigenous peoples did sign treaties, that was, you know, one of the treaties, one of the things that was to be respected was the ability to fish, hunt, and trap, you know, forever. And the inability to fish because the water is being depleted or becoming contaminated is a violation of a constitutionally protected treaty right, first off. And then the fact that the government is trying to put a Water Allocation Act through without I've yet to hear of them including people publicly, including Indigenous communities as well, this dialogue, which they want to pass, you know, sometime this year. And the fact that they're giving precedence, water in industry, the ability to have that, have water at their disposal, like you're saying, first in line, first time. So they're saying that industry has had these licenses longer, so they're first in line. So if the water sources dwindle or deplete, they still have access to water over communities. Very problematic.
Now there's a campaign with using a term called CO2 colonialism, or colonialism with a two in there. Can you kind of sort of describe what that is and what it's about?
That's referring to these false solutions predicated in carbon-based markets, essentially where industries that are already polluting would buy quote-unquote permits to continue polluting, whether it be they buy like a forest over here, which is Indigenous territory. They're commodifying a forest and saying, well, we bought this carbon credit because, you know, it's this preserving one forest here, but yet it continues and allows them to continue polluting in, you know, the north, say, for instance, what we see in the tar sands. So we'll see a lot of that more happening. But the very idea is that essentially they're commodifying air, buying carbon. The fact that, you know, making everything a commodity, you know, and we've already seen that this capitalist system hasn't helped, especially in terms of like resource exploitation and extraction. And now it's getting to the point where they need to somehow validate their ability to pollute. So creating these quote unquote carbon credits. And so that's like a part of CO2 colonialism. It's, you know, creating these false solutions essentially for people to think that this carbon-based market is somehow helping avoid climate change when it's not. It's allowing industry to continue polluting.
Okay, so that's important perspective. How has colonialism, from your point of view, affected things beyond CO2, in sort of maybe in a general or even specific terms? Like what is it doing? Because you already touched on a lot of stuff, but I guess one of the thoughts I'm thinking about is that how does it, terms you always hear a lot, and it's things like management, forest management, this kind of management, that kind of management, but those kind of managements forms of colonialism. The forest never needed management before.
Yeah, it's fine the way it is.
Yeah.
If they just leave it alone.
Yeah, exactly. So are there other things that are going on that sort of kind of come to mind as other?
Well, I think it's this whole idea of greenwashing industry, yeah. Right? Yeah. So this idea of clean coal, as if all of a sudden there's this clean coal that's coming out of the earth, but it's not. It's all it is carbon capture and storage is burying their emissions, you know, so leaving for future generations to have to monitor for who knows time immemorial, right? Like the rest of just like nuclear energy, the same thing, as if it's clean, even though, you know, to construct and to actually put in place a nuclear power plant takes a lot of carbon emissions. Because it's not producing at certain points carbon, it doesn't mean that it's not producing carbon. It is. So I think there's these false constructs that we're trying to green fossil fuel based energy system, and that's actually not the case, and it's not plausible. And what we should be doing is transitioning over to a green economy, you know, whether it be through solar or wind, what we have. Because basically what it's crazy is like we're using fossil fuels to produce more fossil fuels instead of using fossil fuels to actually get us out of this situation that we're in and producing more, you know, greener technology. It just really saddens me that the amount of subsidies that go into fossil fuel-based energy systems is just like, it's enormous, the amount of subsidies or the amount of investment. Whereas if they put that into research and development into green energy systems, like how much more competent they could be in the future, but they're not. They're focusing their energies on that. Essentially, like eluding the public, it's like a carbon smoke screen, meaning like saying, oh, there's these solutions, but they're not solutions. False.
Yeah, Suncor has set up SEMA, and it's all about just that greenwashing the industry and the whole thing. And when you read the board of governors on it, they're from, you know, BP, they're from, you know, every oil industry there is out there. Just about, it's just amazing.
Well, they had the Aboriginal Roundtable even be part of this SEMA process, the Cumulative Environmental Management Assessment, but they're not actually doing cumulative studies. They're like, okay, well, how is this affecting your community? And a lot of Indigenous leaders walked away from that roundtable because they said, you're not engaging us in a way that's meaningful. You know what I mean? So there's this idea of like, quote unquote, fake consultation, quote, consultation, which isn't consultation. If you already know what the outcome is going to be, you're just informing people that consultation. That's why there's, you know, this need to shift over to free prior informed consent, because, you know, that's the proper amount of information that you're the full story. And then you have you're informed and you're giving your consent. Whereas consultation doesn't mean that communities have given their consent. Right. It just means that they've been, quote unquote, consulted. But yeah, there's no way to green the tar sands, just for the record. It's the dirtiest form of, you know, oil there is out there. It's like, look at the byproducts that it's producing. How is that green?
Exactly. Yeah.
It's heavy hydrocarbon. Of contaminants.
CAPP, the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, have had even ads all over the place and on TV, especially during the World Cup and stuff like that, when a lot of people are maybe watching, saying how we're making tar sands green through this in-situ process, basically.
Well, in-situ is not. What they're trying to say is that in-situ doesn't have as much of an environmental footprint as green does, but it does. Okay. Because it actually takes more water and more energy and therefore more carbon emissions to produce. Just like I like to think about it out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly.
Essentially superheating steam to 240 degrees Celsius, pushing it down into the ground, and then melting the Earth's core in the bitumen and then bringing it back up. So who knows what kind of geological formations they're you know, hitting on the way, what they might be contaminating, what aquifers are underneath there. Right. You know, there's been community members from Cold Lake who've had in situ the longest have said that there's arsenic in their waterways. Because when you superheat the steam, then it actually changes the chemical composition of arsenic from till A3. It's like from the naturally occurring arsenic that's in the ground, like A3, which is the deadliest form of arsenic, and that's leaching into waterways. So issues like that they're not taking into consideration. They don't have a full cumulative study about what in situ is doing under the ground. So yeah, it doesn't look as bad, but it actually is more insidious because it's actually affecting the underground systems where our watersheds are. Where our sixth of Canada's fresh water supply, which is the Peace Athabasca Delta, is, you know, that's where in situ will take place as well. So if we see the tailing ponds on earth, on the ground, and that's happening under the ground, you know what I mean? And they're actually, they take some of these wells and they actually pump that byproduct back down into the earth or send it away to landfills. Talking about the byproduct that still results from in situ development because it's there. And then also on top of that, it uses more water because you have to superheat the steam. Instead of mining where you heat it to 50 degrees, you heat it to 240 degrees. That takes more water, that takes more energy, that takes more natural gas, and therefore that produces more carbon emissions because some studies that I've seen, like situ for mining, it's 3 to 5 barrels of water for 1 barrel of oil. For in situ, the average is higher than that. It can go up to like, you know, 4 to 6. I've seen some studies where because they're hitting rock on the way down, they're actually using like 18 barrels of water for 1 barrel of oil. So they're using a lot, you know, and that's just like in one circumstance. It's not, but I'm sure like it will increase because a lot of more industries are now saying like we need to withdraw more water because we're running out of water. We don't have enough water. So they're, you know, withdrawing more water from the watersheds. They're using the water and then they're using more natural gas to produce it. So it actually takes more natural gas to produce the tar sand, in situ process.
But they're also talking about how they're reusing this water and stuff like that. Is that actually true or is that just sort of...
Well, they've tried to say that too with mining, you know, like the fact that they can, you know, cycle in water to separate, but eventually it's going to run out. Like, it's not recycling water. They're reusing the water for a certain amount of time, but right. then there's it's never going to go back into the watershed. So right. I think the fact that they're saying recycling is a little bit misleading because right. yeah. it doesn't ever return to the watershed and it should never return to the watershed. And through leaching, is that the only way that it's returning to the watershed? yeah, it shouldn't
yeah,
be.
Yeah, yeah.
But basically that's what they're saying is that, you know, the recycling, but it's just, you know, reusing it until they can no longer reuse it. And now it's waste.
A good explanation on it, Sitsu, because I think that a lot of not everybody really clear on
what this, that is,
what that is in the yeah. process.
It's yeah. just pretty much underground mining.
Just trying to keep the top on. But they still clear. They still have to clear a lot of the
forest. It still completely fragments the forest. It does, because they have to put in roads, transmission lines, you know, for the energy there, pipelines to get the bitumen out, you know, diluent pipelines to get it in and out as well. There's all of these, you know, inroads, seismic development, seismic exploration. So basically the forest is completely fragmented and cut up, so which completely drives away wildlife as well. So okay, so maybe it's not a moonscape, but it's completely fragmented forest, which it serves no purpose. And it's basically like death by a thousand cuts is like a report that came out by the Pembina Institute on Institute. It's called death by a thousand cuts. You're still scarring the landscape. You're still making it, giving it the inability to live like a natural way as like a living, thriving ecosystem. Because, you know, you can die by a thousand cuts too. Like you're eventually it's going to die because you're not letting it live and breathe in the way it should be living.
How can people decolonize themselves where they live?
Learn your history. That's a major, major necessity to happen in Canada. And if you're wanting to do Indigenous solidarity or sovereignty work and be an ally, history, mm-hmm. know what happened on the land in which you live. You know the real history, because the history that they're teaching in school is not the history that actually happened and took place. You know, there's all of these issues. Like, I talked to so many different people grew up here that were born here, still don't know what happened to Indigenous peoples. And, you know, essentially people are living privileged lives off of the backs of Indigenous peoples that have been oppressed for 150 years in this country. So I think the fact that people don't know the history is why there's so much misunderstanding, why there's so much lack of solidarity or working together, because there hasn't been that communication between these communities that needs to take place. But I think first and foremost is learning your history, reading books that people have written. You know, they do exist out there. There's some good history and some gathering of knowledge that people can learn from. Some of the history is hidden away, and that's like another institution of colonial policies is the education system. Growing up, like, I barely remember hearing anything about, like, I think in grade 4 I learned about teepees, which I already knew about, and like we colored them in class, and that's all I learned about school, about what Indigenous peoples in Canada, who they are and what they do, are very basic and be like, you know, not informing on the real issues. And I had to learn all of that from my family, you know, like what happened in residential schools, all the horrendous, you know. And then sometimes you learn, like, if certain students take classes, say, like in the second or third or fourth year of university, that's when people that may not know the history will learn it to a certain extent. And that's when I've actually had conversations or like, oh my gosh, I never knew. It's really sad that people don't know until like their mid-20s mm-hmm. or early 20s about the true history of Canada. And that's only if they take a certain class.
Was the Atawi telling me? She's working with a student who's working on foster care right now, and how foster care is actually becoming the new scoop.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, another example of that, yeah. that whole process. And people just aren't aware.
Yeah.
They just don't. Well, most people don't pay attention to foster care.
I think what I've heard from somewhere, but I don't have where this exact stat is, but I've heard that there's actually more Native children in foster care are adopted out than were even held in residential
yeah,
schools.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing.
Yeah. yeah. So I yeah. think the fact that that's happening, but it's still continuing. Think like, oh, why don't, you know, the whole saying when people say, well, why don't they just get over it? It's like, what is there to get over? It's still happening.
Right.
Like, look around you. Look yeah. at the effects, legacy. Yeah. And like another saying that I really heard, I'm sure you've heard, is like, I have had a friend say, you know, I don't know what it's like to be in, what it was like to attend residential school, but I definitely have a feeling of what it is. You know, because through this process, you know, this generational trauma has been passed down, you know, because yeah. of like whatever these coping mechanisms or these abuse that people experience have been passed on. And that's not our traditional way, but it's been passed on now.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem.
Testament. Yeah. settle for less. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. We got one planet, let's protect what's left. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. I said protect Mother Earth, don't settle for less. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. We got one planet, let's protect what's left. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. This ain't Canada, this is Total Island, man. Fuck the Maple Leaf, I'll never fly the fucking flag again. Colonizing genocide is what it represents. Onto reservations, ethnic cleansing, they still stealing land. In the present tense, Tandalaga, Sealish Coast, riot 2010. They cut grassy marrows, will it ever end? If we don't stand up, our next generation's dead. So wake up, get out of bed and stop the bulldozers from moving ahead. This goes out to all my warriors, all of my rebels. We need to sabotage these industrial devils. What goes around comes around like bicycle pedals. So take back every inch of this land that was settled. Protect Mother Earth, don't settle for less. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. We got one planet, let's protect what's left. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. I said protect Mother Earth, don't settle for less. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. We got one planet, let's protect what's left. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. No time to talk, man, no time for games. It's time to block highways and block the trains. Keep your money, cause I want change. And we ain't all tame like Phil Fontaine. Shouldn't we be enraged if they kidnapped kids and kept them encaged? Caught the propaganda, poisoned the brain, so that the wrong culture made them ashamed and dumped tens of thousands and no more graves. Canadian genocide, church and state. Canadian genocide, never again. Cause every inch of Total Island is getting reclaimed. Protect Mother Earth, don't settle for less. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. We got one planet, let's protect what's left. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. Protect Mother Earth, don't settle for less. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. This ain't Canada, this is Total Island, man. Fuck the Maple Leaf, I'll never fly the fucking flag again. This ain't Canada, this is Total Island, man. Fuck the Maple Leaf, I'll never fly the fucking flag again. This ain't Canada, this is Total Island, man. Fuck the Maple Leaf, I'll never fly the fucking flag again. This ain't Canada, this is Total Island, man. Fuck the Maple Leaf, I'll never fly the fucking flag again.
And that was Testament with Turtle Island. On the next show of Colonialism is Alive and Well, we'll have Wazia Dawi. And I have a great article of hers on the website, so I ask you to check it out. Also on the website, I put on a song by John Trudell. Sort of resonated with me as well, because Melina was talking about how they've commodified, and they've commodified the forest, and they've commodified the air, and all these things. And in his song Crazy Horse by John Trudell, he was asking, putting forward the questions that Crazy Horse was asking, is how do you do this? How do you sell your mother? How do you sell the air? How do you? And this is what we've come to. This is what we've become. And in the closing part of the video, you know, the closing video says, "Why can't white people act like human beings?" And this is what our culture has become. I think the only experience that Indigenous people have had with whites, for the most part, is through this culture of industrialization, this culture of greed, and basically what the Cree have called the Witigo, this legendary cannibal of that eats everything, including itself, out of greed. And this is what's happening to our world right now. It's being eaten not only for concepts, not just greed, but people's power, people's wills, and concepts around that. Yeah, I have to agree with Sitting Bull. Where the hell did we go wrong? You know, when do we stop becoming when do we stop being human beings? Human beings live with the planet, not against it. Human beings live with the earth, not against it. This is what human beings do. Human beings don't sell out the boreal forest to the market. The market is fantasy. Human beings live with the planet. When will we return to being human beings. When will we return to being human beings? When will those who wish to live with the planet stop this culture? When will those who wish to live with this planet stop this culture? So taking us out is Resident Antihero with Don't Let Them In. Have a good night, and remember, the Resistance needs you.
Begin and swear on our graves that we won't let them win.
Don't let them in, I won't let them in.